Trib Live is made possible by AT&T, NRG, Christus Health, and BP.
Please join me in welcoming Ted Cruz. Thank you again for being here. Put you right over there. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Really appreciate it. So let me start with last night and the Obama speech. I'm sure you chose it over the football game.
Was kept with riveted attention.
Were you? Great. Okay. Riveted. You were riveted by it. So since you were riveted by it, I'm sure you can give me a detailed critique. I'm going to just go out on a limb here and say you probably didn't much like it.
That is fair to say.
Yeah.
I actually think last night was typical of the problems with this administration. President Obama is a true believer, and he believes in government. It's his answer for everything: more government spending, more government control, more power in Washington. What was most striking, nothing the president proposed last night will create jobs. Virtually all of it is the status quo. Virtually all of it is maintain the current payroll tax holiday, which means maintain the status quo. This last month, that created zero jobs.
Well, Mr. Cruz, Mark Zandi, the chief economist for the Moody's rating agency, last night, in fact, said that the Obama plan would create 1.9 million jobs and would result in a 2% increase in GDP and a 1% decrease in the unemployment rate. What do you say about that?
You know, I seem to recall President Obama's economist saying the last stimulus plan would result in unemployment below 8%.
Well, this is an outside economist from Moody's, a respected rating agency. Do you disbelieve what he's saying about this?
Yes, I absolutely disbelieve it. And look, I'm reminded of that there's an old classic Saturday Night Live skit where Christopher Walken is producing a rock band, and there's a person that keeps playing an annoying cowbell. Mm-hmm. And in the old skit, Christopher Walken's solution to everything is more cowbell. We need more cowbell. The same is true with President Obama. He knows one thing: more cowbell. Whatever the problem is, we need more spending. We need more federal government control. If you look at the different pieces of it, none of them actually affect incentives. The problem is this administration doesn't understand where jobs come from. A payroll tax holiday that is a temporary holiday is effectively the same thing as sending a check to everyone. It is pure Keynesian stimulus, and the problem is Keynesian stimulus doesn't work. The only thing that works in terms of incentives is affecting marginal tax rates going forward and affecting the incentives going forward.
So the people who say that the problem with the economy today is not that people aren't hiring, it's that people aren't spending. And that therefore, if we create a payroll tax holiday or we allow for a certain amount of money to come back into the hands of the American consumer, and that therefore they spend that money, that's going to fix things. You're not buying that.
No, I'm not buying that. And you know, the problem we have is not too little government spending. It's not like if only the federal government thought about spending some money, that would fix the problem. The fundamental problem is very simple. This administration has engaged in an unrelenting war on jobs. This week, in anticipation of the president's speech last night, I launched our 12-point jobs and growth agenda.
Right, this was published on National Review Online.
Yes.
And in fact, I've got a couple of the things right here that you proposed, in fact. You proposed slashing the corporate tax rate. You proposed reforming entitlements, reining in the Fed, repealing Obamacare, balanced budget amendment. I mean, I will say, without disrespect, this is standard fare these days for a candidate from your side of the Republican spectrum. This is a lot of ideas we've heard before, but you've put this together in a plan that you think trumps the president.
Well, it's interesting you think it's standard fare. Yesterday, Senator Jim DeMint, the strongest conservative in the U.S. Senate,
endorsed you in this race.
Who has endorsed me in this race, sent out an email to thousands of conservatives across the country attaching my plan and suggesting it as a model for every conservative candidate in the country.
But here's
the difference, and here's why it's not standard. Look, you could say on one level, okay, you oppose Obamacare and are for cutting taxes. Every Republican says that.
Right.
But there's a difference. I mean, you asked what creates jobs.
Right.
The first six of these steps are stopping the Obama war on jobs, and there are a series of policies that have systematically killed jobs. Obamacare is killing thousands of jobs. Cap and trade, which Obama has been pushing both legislatively and through the back door of the EPA, has the potential to kill thousands of jobs.
The not in place yet, but it's the prospect of it.
But it's killing the jobs because if you talk to business owners, what they say is there is incredible uncertainty. They don't know what the regulators are going to do. They know that Washington is coming at them and putting more and more burdens, more and more taxes, more and more barriers, and that's why they're not investing.
But you grant the cap and trade has zero chance of passing any time in our lifetime right now, right?
Well, except that it's passing through the back door through the EPA.
So you're saying that sort of statutory what they're doing is what they can't accomplish legislatively.
Well, and in fact, look at the offshore drilling moratorium. The chances of a drilling moratorium through Congress are zero. So what did the Obama administration do?
Come through the back door.
Dictated it like a monarch.
Right.
And a federal court of appeals in a case I litigated for the Chamber of Commerce concluded that the drilling moratorium was contrary to federal law.
Mr. Cruz, was there anything that the president could have said last night that you would have supported? I mean,
absolutely.
Realistically, give me some things that you think. I mean, not fantasy, but reality. What? Not the president suddenly flips and now he's a Tea Party Republican or he's a conservative Republican. But the president in the situation that he's in, is there anything that he could have said that you and your side would have supported?
I would have supported anything that reduces the burden of government on job creators. There's a fundamental difference in philosophy. President Obama believes government creates jobs. Government doesn't create jobs. The only jobs government can create is government employees.
So the people who are in government and who are at the head of government should not claim credit for job creation?
They don't create jobs. Now, what government can do incredibly well is kill jobs.
Right. But
the only thing that creates jobs is private entrepreneurs putting capital to work to meet a demonstrated need, which means you can have government leaders, number one, kill jobs, like President Obama has done, or number two, put in place policies that empower and unleash the private sector.
So when candidates go around the country or go around the state claiming to have created jobs or taking credit for the creation of jobs, they do so not because they themselves created them, but because they created the conditions that allowed private business to create jobs.
I think that's a fair way to
characterize. Fair way to say it. Much of what you've described, and I would encourage people to go to the National Review site, Mr. Cruz's plan is laid out in detail. Much of what you propose actually echoes the plan being put forward for the country by Rick Perry, running for president, who you endorsed nearly a month ago. You were very early on the Rick Perry, nothing you've seen in the last couple of weeks has made you think bad choice. He's still your guy.
I am enthusiastic about Governor Perry as a presidential candidate.
Let me ask you a couple of things then that come off of your plan that relate to the governor's campaign. Let me ask you if you agree with what the governor said, since you are so much in sync on policy issues. One of the things that you have in your 12-point plan is reform entitlements. Mm-hmm. Yes or no, is Social Security a Ponzi scheme?
You know, was Brian Williams writing these questions?
Oh, yeah, it's a simple question. Yes or no, is Social Security a Ponzi scheme?
You know, there was a funny exchange in that debate, because obviously Brian Williams asked.
I'll be asking you again. Go ahead, tell your story, but I will be asking you again.
The funny exchange is Brian Williams asked Rick Perry, is it a Ponzi scheme? Rick Perry says, yes, because he wrote a book and said it was a Ponzi scheme.
Said it was a Ponzi scheme.
And Brian Williams says, my God, how can you say that? That rhetoric is so overheated. And, you know, there is a level at which words have meaning. Mm-hmm. What does the word Ponzi scheme mean? A Ponzi scheme is a system. If you and I cooked up a Ponzi scheme, we would have current people pay into it.
Right.
We would take the money and we would pay it out to other recipients. That's the definition of a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
In the English language, that is exactly how Social Security operates.
So I'm going to take that as a yes, that you believe that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme.
I think there is an effort to treat that as rhetoric, but there's no doubt that's what it is.
But Mr. Cruz, let me be clear. I'm not criticizing the governor nor you for overheated rhetoric. I'm simply, since you say words matter, I'm simply asking, you're calling for entitlements to be reined in. You either do believe or don't believe that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme.
I think Social Security is a vital bulwark of our society and provides important stability to millions of seniors.
So
it's a commitment we've made. And part of the reason why it's a loaded question is if you ask...
Oh, I know it's a loaded question.
And you know well it's a loaded question. If you ask, is it a Ponzi scheme? If the question is the mechanism using current payments to pay current recipients, then the answer is unquestionably yes. And the fact that Brian Williams, that makes him sweat, It doesn't make the English language, it doesn't make words mean something other than what they mean.
It doesn't make me sweat. Let me ask it a different way. Mitt Romney made a point in response to Governor Perry on that stage the other night and said, I don't want to abolish Social Security, I want to save it. Would you put yourself in that camp?
Absolutely, and that's a real contrast. Look, President Obama and the Democrats in Congress want to run away from Social Security reform. And if they do that, they are killing Social Security. I'll tell you, I am campaigning on fundamental entitlement reform. Right. On Social Security, I am campaigning on a series of very specific reforms. Mm-hmm. Four parts. Number one, for seniors receiving Social Security or near Social Security, there should be no change in benefits whatsoever. Okay. We've made a solemn promise to them, and we need to stand by that promise. But for people of our generation, for younger workers, a lot of folks our age don't think Social Security is going to be there to begin with. Mm-hmm. They understand the finances, it's headed towards bankruptcy right now, and the politicians are showing no backbone to resolve it. For younger workers, we need to do three fundamental reforms. Number one, gradually increase the retirement age. When Social Security was adopted, the average life expectancy was 62, and Social Security kicked in at 65. It was designed to be at the very later age, stages of life. Now the average life expectancy is 78. We need to gradually increase it and allow time for younger workers to save and get ready, knowing that Social Security will come at a later stage in life. Mm. Number two, Social Security benefits right now grow about 1% greater than inflation. We should have those benefits grow at the rate of inflation, not 1% more. Those two changes, you take compounded growth of growing 1% more every year, that solves the solvency problem in Social Security. But the third change that I think is absolutely critical is to allow taxpayers to have a portion of the Social Security funds go to a personal account that they own and control. And the biggest reason for that is not even solvency.
Yep.
It's ownership. It allows, in particular, low-income workers, people cleaning houses, mowing lawns, working hard out in the sun, over the course of 40 years of working to accumulate significant assets, which they can pass on to their kids, they can use to buy a house, they can use to start a business, to get an education. The focus should be on empowering individuals, not empowering government bureaucrats in Washington.
Okay. Well, then let me try another one on you actually here. So you worked in both the Bush administration in Washington, and then you worked as Solicitor General under Governor Perry, so you know both these men. There is perceived or real, I'm not going to say which it is because you hear different opinions about this, tension between the Bush folks and the Perry folks. And in fact, back on in the 2008 presidential campaign, when he was campaigning on behalf of Rudolph Giuliani in Iowa, Governor Perry famously said, George Bush was not a fiscal conservative, never was. You are a big advocate for cutting spending. This question of fiscal conservatism is central to your core. Do you believe that Governor Perry is right, that Governor Bush was not a fiscal conservative?
You know, I'm not really interested in engaging in my assessment of every Republican on the face of the planet.
Well, I'm just asking about that one. I promise I'll limit it to that one.
You know what? Over a decade ago, I had the great honor of working for George W. Bush on his campaign. As you know, my wife Heidi worked on the campaign also. I met my wife Heidi on the campaign. There were actually 8 marriages that came out of that campaign. Which is a great thing. You bring a bunch of 20-somethings together, you work them 18 hours a day, and things happen. As a result of that, what I say in response to any questions like this is, my wife and I met on the Bush campaign. In our family, whatever else anyone says about George W. Bush, in our house, he will always be a uniter and not a divider.
Good. Well, I think that's a very classy answer. I'm gonna leave you at that. Let me ask you about another thing. Another thing that has come up in the course of your campaign, and also in the course of the presidential campaign, that I think is an important thing to understand your position on. You were a fellow at, and I believe in fact headed, the 10th Amendment Center at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. You are as associated with the 10th Amendment and the core principles of the 10th Amendment as anybody in politics in Texas today. You're a big 10th Amendment guy. Governor Perry has been a big 10th Amendment guy as well, wrote an entire book, Fed Up, that outlined in great detail his 10th Amendment principles, and he has been fairly disciplined about those principles, except on the presidential campaign trail, he's backed off of the 10th Amendment in calling for a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage and a constitutional amendment to ban abortion. As a United States Senator, Senator Cruz might be asked to take part in conversations on these two issues. I think it's fair game to ask you about that today. That, to my reading, runs smack into a fealty to the 10th Amendment. If you believe that states should be left alone to decide on those issues and other issues, why have a constitutional amendment? That was where Governor Perry seemed inconsistent on the 10th Amendment. I wonder if you agree with him that we should have a constitutional amendment on those two issues. You're very strongly pro-life and against gay marriage. Or are you comfortable with the 10th Amendment leaving it to the states?
You know, I actually think your question reveals precisely the opposite about Governor Perry than what you suggest.
All right.
The fact that he proposes a constitutional amendment to do it reflects that he understands that without an amendment, the 10th Amendment protects it for the states. It's entirely consistent to say, look, the 10th Amendment limits the power of the federal government and protects the states. That's the status quo. However, there is a policy issue. In the two cases you raised, protecting the right to life and protecting traditional marriage, where he's made a policy decision that there should be a national answer, and rather than going and trying to find some judge to decree it to be so,
right,
the proper method to do that, given the 10th Amendment, is to pass a new constitutional amendment that becomes part of the Constitution. That is entirely consistent with respecting the document that has created our republic and limited our government.
But why wouldn't the 10th Amendment, if you read it literally, say every state should be prevented, or we should prevent the federal government from putting its boot heel on the necks of the 50 states on policy questions? States should be allowed to decide themselves. So if the state of New York decides they want to pass same-sex marriage, that's on them. We don't want to do that here in Texas. They're entitled to do what they do, because by giving them that right, we're entitled to do what we do.
But that's the status quo. What you're missing is, by proposing a constitutional amendment, one constitutional amendment can trump another constitutional amendment. That's how you interpret the Constitution. So, for example, the 10th Amendment limits federal government authority. Article 1, Section 8 lays out 20 powers of Congress. Congress has the power to create a post office, to give an example.
It's not doing very well these days.
It's doing a lousy job.
Right, yeah.
But it is a clear constitutional authority.
Right.
Now, you could say, well, isn't a post office inconsistent with the 10th Amendment? Well, no, because the Constitution gives the federal government the authority to do that. All these amendments would do is give the federal government specific power, and the 10th Amendment remains the bulwark protecting the authority of the states and fundamentally the people. You know, the 10th Amendment, I think, is widely misunderstood. I don't think of it as a question of states' rights. The 10th Amendment is fundamentally a question of individual liberty. I mean, what James Madison referred to in the Federalist Papers, he said, the great challenge of creating a government, he said, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. The great challenge is to enable the government to govern and at the same time to oblige them to govern itself.
But I'm going to try one more time on this and then we'll move on. Wouldn't a commitment to individual liberty suggest that despite the government's desire to make same-sex marriage illegal, that individuals, if they so chose, or states, if they so chose, would still be able to say, we have the right to exercise our liberty in making this the case?
People could have a genuine philosophical disagreement about that.
Right.
My point is, there is nothing remotely inconsistent with saying, I respect the 10th Amendment, I want to defend the 10th Amendment,
yeah,
and saying there is an additional constitutional amendment that should be passed to give the federal government power on one specific area. Both of those reflect a fidelity to the Constitution. Both of those say a president or a Congress or an unelected judge doesn't have the power to just make it up, to just seize power. What President Obama did with Obamacare is seized power with the individual mandate that the Constitution doesn't give the federal government.
And you believe that the legislature of the state of New York did the same on same-sex marriage?
No.
Seized power?
No. Look, I believe that they enacted a wrong-headed policy decision.
Yep.
But it's their constitutional prerogative to do that.
In the absence of a constitutional amendment.
In the absence of a constitutional amendment.
Right.
I'll give you an example. Suppose President Obama, in passing Obamacare, has suggested, let's have a constitutional amendment allowing Congress to create an individual mandate. Now, that would be terribly wrong-headed policy, but it wouldn't be unconstitutional. It would be the right mechanism,
yep,
to propose, and then you could have a debate, do we agree the federal government
the
should have this power?
On the substance, yeah.
There's a big difference between that and saying, well, the Constitution doesn't give us this power, But we're going to just assert we have it anyway.
We're going to take it. All right. Let me ask you about another federal issue that's come up recently, and it's a way to get into the debt ceiling conversation, which you had strong opinions about and very early on as well. Yesterday, Senator Cornyn joined House Majority Leader Eric Cantor in calling for federal disaster relief. And we live in a state, of course, the backdrop of this conversation is the terrible devastation that Central Texas has realized through the wildfires. Senator Cornyn joined Mr. Cantor in calling for federal disaster relief to be tied to spending cuts. So no spending cuts that offset federal disaster relief, no federal disaster relief would come to Texas. What do you think about that?
Look, I think we have a spending crisis. I think we have a federal government that is addicted to spending. 40 cents of every dollar the federal government spends is borrowed. If you and I did that in our own households, we would be bankrupt.
Mr. Cruz, that's a very disciplined answer, but I want to ask you about federal spending versus federal disaster relief.
Do I support it? Yes. Do I support? You can throw 100 scenarios at me.
Well, I'm just throwing one.
In which the punchline of all of them is, would you support using X mechanism to limit federal spending? And my answer to all of them will be yes.
So I'm simply asking you if in the case of Senator Cornyn's calling for disaster relief to be tied to spending
cuts,
you support
yes.
that idea. Okay. On the debt ceiling debate, your response on whether you would vote against the deal was not tepid.
No.
It was not just no, it was hell no. And I commend you for not waffling or for not obscuring your position. Some of the other positions taken in this race might not have been as clear as yours. Yours was clear from the very first line. You know that the result of the debt ceiling debate was that Standard & Poor's downgraded the country's debt rating to AA+. Huge crisis. But if you read the text behind the decision, they seem to put the responsibility for the downgrade on members of Congress, both sides, for not being serious enough in their attempts to solve the problem. Do you not believe that this debate is ultimately responsible for the crisis that we have right now? I mean, for the debt ceiling crisis? Or do you disagree with Standard & Poor's logic that the rationale for the downgrade should be something else?
Look, there's no doubt that the lousy debt deal was a very significant cause of the downgrade. It's part of the reason I opposed it.
Yeah.
It was a deal that didn't solve the problem. And the reason it didn't solve the problem is President Barack Obama and the Democrats in Congress were adamantly opposed to any real spending cuts. And at the same time, look, I mean, I'm not just throwing rocks at one party. The people driving that spending train have been the Democrats. But many of the people sitting in the passenger seat smiling along have been squishy Republicans in Washington. A huge part of the problem with what we have in Washington is an awful lot of establishment Republicans who have been utterly complicit in this explosion of federal government spending. And the problem is that there are a lot of Republicans that view the highest goal as compromise. And the way a Democrat and a Republican compromise in Washington is I agree to spend for your project and you agree to spend for my project. And the person that loses is the taxpayers who get robbed collectively by a bipartisan coalition.
By what definition was this debt deal a compromise? The one that you opposed. How was it a compromise? What did the Republicans give up?
They raised the debt ceiling.
Which they had done 17 times during the Bush administration without incident. How is that a compromise?
Because we're at a crisis point. The debt ceiling is a mechanism to have a debate about the level of spending, and we are at a crisis point. We are approaching 100% of our GDP being our national debt. Now look, that's on a path. You don't have to look far. Look at Europe. Look at Greece. If we keep having politicians that spend 40% more than they take in, it will destroy our nation. It will bankrupt our nation. Now, I believe with all of my heart, that will not happen because Americans care about freedom. The Tea Party movement is a result of millions of Americans saying, stop these clowns in Washington.
But if everybody had voted no, as you did, because they found the deal to be insufficient, and we had defaulted, would you say that would have been a disaster? Would you believe that the default threat was false? What do you think would have happened?
I think the premise of your question is false.
Go.
President Obama recklessly and deliberately threatened a default. In my and that was a deliberate tactic to use it as scaremongering. In my opinion, any responsible president at the start of the debt ceiling debate would have said the following: under no circumstances will the United States of America ever default on its debt. Period. Whatever happens in the debt ceiling, we will not default in our debt. Federal government revenues are approximately $200 billion a month. Service on the debt is approximately $20 billion a month. There are ample revenues to meet the debt obligations regardless of what happens on the debt
ceiling. So it was a phony threat.
It was a phony, and it was a deliberate phony threat, because what the president and the Democrats wanted to do is scare people that a financial apocalypse would happen, the markets would melt down, the economy would melt down. And, you know, Senator Pat Toomey introduced legislation that would require, in the event of a debt ceiling and a government shutdown, that the debt always be met so that there is never a default. And the Democrats said, absolutely not, because we want to play brinksmanship. We want to scare people and threaten a default. That was grossly irresponsible on the other side. Now, what would have happened if the debt ceiling hadn't been erased? That would have been significant. 40 cents of every dollar we spend is borrowed. It would have been essentially like another government shutdown. 40% of federal government spending would have stopped until the issue was resolved. Now, that's not a long-term solution, but it's not catastrophic. You know, I was living in Washington in 1995. I was actually clerking for the federal court, getting ready to clerk for Chief Justice Rehnquist during the last government shutdown. And I remember one of the funnier things. The Department of Commerce, 70% of the employees didn't come to work. And they put out press releases that said, fear not, 100% of the essential services of the department are being taken care of. And I remember laughing, going, well, what a great indictment. Apparently 70% of these people are not needed.
Lay these people off, right?
If it does everything it needs to do without
30%,
them.
Right, yeah.
That says an awful lot.
The cynics will say, Mr. Cruz, that the Republican Party is playing politics here, and they didn't want a really good debt ceiling deal, an ambitious one, just as they don't want a jobs plan to pass, simply because they're looking ahead to 2012, and anything that they agree to that ultimately helps the president does more to help his reelection. So it's in your interest and the party's interest to thwart him so that he is in a worse position for reelection. What do you say about that?
What I say is that any principled member of Congress puts protecting the interests of the United States first. On the debt ceiling debate, I was the second Senate candidate in the country to sign the cut, cap, and balance pledge. And I was very clear in what circumstances I would have voted for it.
Yep.
Now, that's not playing politics. That's not hiding anything. Now, it happened to be an outcome that was not consistent with the policy objectives of the president.
Right.
The policy objectives of the president are wrong, are hurting the country, and are destroying jobs.
This is on principle, not politics.
This is absolutely on principle.
Let me use the remaining time we have left to talk about the Senate race. You were quoted in a story in the Dallas Morning News yesterday. Bob Garrett, great reporter for the Dallas News, had covered the Austin Republican Women's Forum. And Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst, candidate in this race, did not show up for that forum, as he has declined to appear at a number of Tea Party forums around the state. You accused him of hiding from Republicans, hiding from voters. Would you care to take another swing at that ball for my benefit?
Look, in the 6-7 weeks since Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst has entered the race, there have been 8 candidate forums. He skipped 7 of them.
What do you think's going on here? Is he taking a knee? Do you think he's trying to just win this race by not? Is it a Rose Garden strategy? What is it?
You know what? I am not going to presume to know what is going on inside Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst's head. What I will say is several things. Number one,
we need a fake David Dewhurst Twitter feed to actually tell us, don't we? Yeah.
Number one, I don't believe any candidate is going to be able to buy this race. Simply writing a check and doing TV commercials, if that is their strategy, that strategy will lose. I'll tell you, at every one of these events, and these are what's interesting, these are Tea Party events, they're Republican women events, they're county party events. This is across the spectrum. You have 200-400 grassroots activists, conservative activists, Republican women. The moderator invariably says, we invited David Dewhurst to participate. He refused to attend. And the entire room boos.
Right.
Now, if you go, the Denton County Republican Party, there were over 400 activists there. If you go and tell the grassroots all across the state, in Denton County, in Austin, in Waco, in Clear Lake, in Kerrville, all of which he's missed, If you tell all of them, we don't care about the grassroots, we don't care about the primary voters, that's a strategy that will lose.
What is wrong with Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst substantively? Leave aside the tactic of not attending these forums. What do you disagree with Lieutenant Governor on specifically? What do you specifically disagree with him on? What actions as Lieutenant Governor has he taken that you would not have? Give me the substantive critique of Lieutenant Governor.
Absolutely. Listen, let me say, I think Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst is a smart man. I think he's a hard worker, and I think he's a decent human being. I like Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst personally.
This is setting up like my blind date had a nice personality. Come on.
Well, and I also think it's not worth a second blind date. In my opinion, Texas deserves two things from the next senator: a strong conservative and a fighter.
Is he a strong conservative?
No.
Is he a fighter?
No. President Barack Obama, in my judgment, is the most radical president this country's ever seen. We are facing a crisis where the federal government is engaged in a war on jobs, and what is at jeopardy is individual liberty and the Constitution. Texas, look, we are too strong a state, too conservative of a state to have a spineless senator. We need somebody leading the fight.
Do you think David Dewhurst is spineless?
What I think is that his career in government, what he prides himself on, or at least prior to this year he prided himself on, was being a conciliator. Evan, how many times have you heard Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst talk about his wonderful ability to bring every Democrat in the room and reach a compromise? He's very proud of that.
Sounds like Governor Bush, though, also. But
there was a big difference, which is that Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst's record, the substance of the compromise hasn't mattered. All that's mattered is that everyone comes together. If it's a compromise, then that's the end solution. Look, Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst has publicly suggested the state of Texas should have an income tax. Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst has publicly castigated
business. If Governor Dewhurst were here, he would absolutely deny that he supports an income tax.
You know, but the problem is he said it in the press, and the news media has a way of keeping records. So I can't help what he said publicly.
Can you produce after this forum a single clip where Governor Dewhurst supported an income tax?
I can show you the quotes.
Mr. Drogan has my email.
I can show you the quotes. But not only that, he has publicly castigated Texas businesses. Businesses need to pay more of their fair share of taxes in Texas. You know, I happen to disagree with the Lieutenant Governor. I don't think business is undertaxed in Texas. Just this last session, he appointed a committee of senators with a specific task: go explore, quote, revenue enhancers. Now, those are his words, not mine. Now, in the English language, revenue enhancers means new taxes.
Well, not only new taxes. It might mean fees.
You know what?
You don't play semantic games.
Exactly. Yeah. English words have meaning. And is there a difference? Absolutely, there's a difference. A strong fiscal conservative, as you know well, when the House passed a budget, a conservative budget that didn't raise taxes, that balanced the budget and didn't cap the rainy day fund, Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst led a group of senators out on the stage blasting the budget, saying we're going to spend billions of dollars of the rainy day fund. Why? Because we're not cold-hearted, mean Republicans like those people in the House. You know, I mean, one of the interesting things of this last session, Evan, as you know, a great many conservative activists and Tea Party activists were very critical of the Speaker of the House, Joe Strauss. By any measure, Joe Strauss had a much more conservative session than David Dewhurst did. The House was much more conservative than the Senate was. The Senate was the place bills like sanctuary cities, the ban on sanctuary cities, and the ban on TSA groping, the Senate was the place they went to die, and they went to die because David Dewhurst doesn't like to stand up and fight for principle.
Are you endorsing Joe Strauss for speaker today?
What I'm saying is, if you look at their records, that contrast is very clear. And I will point out, an institution that you have some familiarity with, Texas Monthly, agreed exactly with that sentiment, which is why he was listed as one of the worst legislators last month, because the way to make...
I'm done explaining for Burka, so I'm done.
But look, the way to make decisions in politics is not to put your finger in the air. It's not to see which way the wind is blowing. I mean, what was interesting about the fight over the rainy day fund is initially Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst blasted the House and said, we're going to spend the rainy day fund. Now, I don't agree with that, but that's at least a principled position. So fine, if he wants to defend that principled position, that's great. What happened then? Governor Perry began criticizing him and saying, show some fiscal restraint. And suddenly he flipped and said, no, I changed my mind. Let's not spend the rainy day fund. And as you know well, the senators that he had walked out on a limb and said, let's go do this together, they looked back at him and said, why'd you saw this limb off? Mm-hmm. Now, he can be for tax and spend. He can be for limited government, but he can't be for both at the same time. And the problem we have had in Washington is an awful lot of Republicans exactly like that. On one day, they give a speech about what great fiscal conservatives they are. On the next day, they say, let's raise taxes and spend more money. And that's a big part of what got Barack Obama elected in the first place, is Republicans were not standing for limited government, individual liberty, and the Constitution. Okay. That's what the next Texas senator needs to stand for.
All right, well, we got to stop here and let the audience come in with questions. But first, let's give our guest a hand, Ted Cruz. Very nice to be here. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. All right, so we've got about 15 or 20 minutes for questions. I did not mention Mike McCall. Perhaps I can encourage a questioner to ask about the potential complication or not that he presents to that race. And any other questions you want to ask? Paul, first question. Microphone will go around.
Thank you, sir. I'll let somebody else ask the McCall question. I'm curious about infrastructure. I think an increase in infrastructure nationally is a good idea and would promote job growth. What do you see the role of the federal government in promoting and possibly obviously paying for infrastructure improvements both in transportation and information? And do you think those could result in jobs?
That was a component of President Obama's plan last night, wasn't it?
You know, it was, and thank you for that question. It's a great question. There's no doubt that building roads is a core function of government and an important function of providing basic infrastructure. What is interesting about the president's job proposal, both last night and a year ago in the stimulus plan, is he always leads with roads because they're popular. And they make sense, but it's all political theater. If you look at the stimulus plan, what he talked about incessantly is, let's spend $800 billion building roads. What they in fact passed was a bill that built very few roads, but it paid off union bosses, it paid off public employee unions, it paid off Acorn, it paid off a bunch of political debts, and it was sold as being about building roads. Should the government build roads? Absolutely. Now, at the end of the day, is that going to fix the jobs problem in this country? No. Building more roads is not going to fix the problem. The problem that we have for jobs is coming from a federal government that is engaged in an unrelenting war on jobs. Let me give you an example, one of the 12 points I talk about in my plan. The National Labor Relations Board right now is trying to force Boeing to shut down a plant in South Carolina, in Charleston, to fire thousands of workers. And the reason is because South Carolina is a right-to-work state. And the Obama administration is telling them, you cannot open a new plant in a right-to-work state. And in fact, and this is incredible, Evan, the position of the Obama administration is, if they shut down the plant and they move it overseas, if they move it to China, that's fine. That's perfectly okay if you hire people overseas. But in the United States, you cannot hire a U.S. worker unless they're subject to the authority of union bosses and paying mandatory union dues. Now, that is crazy. And it's part of the point, you know, you criticized my plan as being conventional. Part of the point is each of these points are not isolated. They are a unified philosophy. Every economic policy of this administration expands the power of government and attacks job creators and entrepreneurs, and it's why over 25 million people are out of work, because the federal government is engaged in an unrelenting war on jobs, and we need to stop that.
All right. Other questions? We'll walk the microphone around to you. One over here. Ma'am.
I'm just curious, when you were Solicitor General of Texas, mm-hmm. Were there any cases that you worked on that, in hindsight now, you might have approached differently?
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't have a good answer for it. I will say, being Solicitor General of the state of Texas was an incredible opportunity. Number one, it was an incredible opportunity to be appointed by Greg Abbott, our Attorney General, who is my dear friend and mentor, and I think he's the finest Attorney General in the whole country. But number two, it was an incredible opportunity to spend 5.5 years fighting for conservative principles. And it was a position I loved having the opportunity to serve in because it gave an opportunity to stand and fight for principles I believe in, I care about, and for Texas to take the lead. And so nationally, Texas led the nation defending conservative principles. We defended the Ten Commandments at the Supreme Court and won. We defended the Pledge of Allegiance at the Supreme Court and won. We defended the Second Amendment at the Supreme Court and won. And we stood up and defended U.S. sovereignty. We fought the World Court and the United Nations and the President of the United States in a case I argued twice at the U.S. Supreme Court and won. And so I will say, to have the opportunity to represent the state of Texas and to stand and fight and defend conservative principles was an incredible privilege, and I'm honored to have had the chance to do that.
Other questions? Mr. Hammond.
Mr. Cruz, would you comment on what changes you would propose for Medicare and Medicaid, please, sir?
It's a great question. Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, we have an entitlements crisis. Any politician that says they want to balance the federal budget and is not willing to talk about fundamental entitlement reform is blowing smoke. 60% of the federal budget is entitlements and interest on the debt. You cannot bring the budget under control without fundamental entitlement reform. We talked about Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid. For both of those, I'll tell you, fundamentally, the first thing in healthcare we need to do is repeal Obamacare. On Medicare and Medicaid, I support the Ryan Plan. I support sending more authority, more power back to the states, allowing the states to experiment. Part of the problem right now, there's so many federal mandates attached to Medicare and Medicaid, they're driving up costs enormously. One of the things Evan mentioned is I led the Center for 10th Amendment Studies at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. One of the ideas we pioneered in the Center for 10th Amendment Studies was the idea of using interstate compacts to, number one, attack Obamacare, and number two, to bring control over health care policy back to the state level. That was an idea that we launched and really pioneered that has in turn picked up steam. The Texas legislature passed a bill this session authorizing an interstate compact to do exactly that. We've got to, on Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, on all of them, engage in fundamental entitlement reform that protect the basic promises we've made to our citizens, but ensure we can pay for them going forward. And, you know, it goes back to a question, Evan, you asked before. The Democrats invariably, nationally, will demagogue the heck out of a Republican for talking about entitlements. They will, in fact, with Paul Ryan, they did this quite literally. They ran ads showing him literally throwing Granny off a cliff. I mean, you know the demagoguery is coming the instant you mention that. But the truth of the matter is the Democrats, by doing nothing on entitlement reform, are destroying Medicare. Medicare is on a path to bankruptcy. And if the Democrats maintain the status quo, they will let it go bankrupt. And their approach, I think, is profoundly cynical, which is just to demagogue any effort to save it and do nothing whatsoever.
Like Social Security, Mr. Cruz, you're not looking to abolish Medicare. You're simply looking to do something different with it.
Absolutely. Both of those programs need to be saved. They need to be programs that will go on long-term, sustainable,
right,
and not in a way unhinged from the laws of arithmetic.
You know, the Democrats are planning on running against Republicans around the country against the Ryan Plan. They're planning on saying these Republicans in your home state or in your district voted to support a plan that would throw seniors off of Medicare.
You're right. That's what they're planning to do, and they will be showing lots of Republicans the image of throwing Granny off the cliff. They will pay for lots of ads doing that. Now, what's interesting and so cynical about it is they're running against the Ryan plan. It might lead a fair-minded person to ask, well, what's the Democrat plan that's the alternative? And they don't have one. They don't have a Democrat plan. They haven't had a budget in the Senate in over 2 years. So they blast the Ryan plan. You talked about the debt ceiling debate and the default. Standard & Poor's said we need to cut $4 trillion from the federal government budget. The Ryan plan does that. The House passed the Ryan plan. What did the Democrats do? What did President Obama do? He demagogued the other side and never proposed any plan that would do what it would take to stop a default. Their approach is solve none of the problems, keep spending, and ignore the laws of arithmetic, and that's fundamentally irresponsible.
I need to pay attention to the laws of time here for 1 second and be sure we have one more, maybe time for one more question. Ma'am.
Good morning. In the presidential debate, Ron Paul said that he would support abolishing the federal minimum wage. What is your opinion on that?
Good question.
It's a great question. I agree. And I agree with Ron Paul on that.
That you are against the, you would vote to eliminate the minimum wage?
Yes, because I care about opportunity. Look, the minimum wage is one of the most misunderstood policies that exists. The minimum wage hurts low-income workers, and it is driving unemployment. What you look at unemployment among African-American youth, which is in excess of 50%. The minimum wage is a major factor because what the minimum wage does, and yet you look at the history of the minimum wage. The minimum wage was passed initially among pressure from unions, and the reason was high-skilled union workers were facing competitions from unskilled workers. And the unskilled workers would come in and underbid them, and they would get hired because you could hire three unskilled workers to do a job that a skilled worker was doing.
Yep.
And the union workers were losing jobs to unskilled, to teenagers, to minorities. And so what did the union bosses do? They went to their politicians and said, we care about these unskilled workers. Let's put in place a minimum wage and raise their price so that it's not affordable to hire them, because that way they'll only hire us. And it had exactly that effect. That's the history of the minimum wage being adopted. What it does, and look, the people in this room are not making minimum wage. The people that typically, or well, great, are the people that typically are making minimum wage or entry-level jobs. Now, those are often young people. Those are people starting out their career. And you can't climb the economic ladder without getting a job to begin with. And by raising the minimum wage, what you end up doing is causing serious unemployment and closing that first door. You know, my father's first job in this country, he came to the city of Austin in 1957 from Cuba. He had been thrown in prison, he had been tortured in Cuba, and he came here, he was 18, he didn't speak a word of English. He had no possessions, he had $100 sewn into his underwear. My dad's first job was as a dishwasher making 50 cents an hour. And he was thrilled to make 50 cents an hour. He worked 7 days a week washing dishes to pay his way through the University of Texas. If the minimum wage had been $1.50, he wouldn't have been able to get hired, because he was an unskilled immigrant college kid who didn't speak English. And he could get hired for 50 cents an hour, but if you jacked up the minimum wage, he couldn't get hired for $1.50.
Right. Well, I guess you could say there goes the labor vote, Mr. Cruz, but I'm not sure you were going to get it anyway.
I am very comfortable to say there will never be an organization of union bosses for Ted.
For Ted Cruz. Okay, good. Let's leave it at that. You're a good sport. I appreciate you subjecting yourself to this. You could have been somewhere else this morning. And thanks to all of you for coming. Let's give Mr. Cruz a hand again. Great. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Trib Live is made possible by AT&T, NRG, Christus Health, and BP.